Robert Wright is a New York Times bestselling author of The Evolution of God, Non-Zero, The Moral Animal, and Why Buddhism is True. He has written for The New Yorker, The New York Times, Time Magazine, Wired, The Intercept, The Wall Street Journal, and Slate. He's been a senior editor at The Atlantic and at The New Republic, where he also served as acting editor. He was a co-founder of Blogging Heads TV and is currently the president of the Non-Zero Foundation and co-host, along with Mickey Kouse, of a podcast without a clear name, but with a parrot room. Norman Finkelstein is here as well. He is the author of many books that have been translated into over 60 foreign languages, including The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. In the year 2020, Norman was named the fifth most influential political scientist in the world. And his book, I'll Burn That Bridge When I Get to It, is out now from Sublation Media. So, Norman and Robert, thank you both for coming on to what I call the Diet Soap Podcast. Having you here today to discuss the question of free speech, and I guess also woke or identity politics. You know, it's going to be kind of an interesting conversation because Robert is not like a pro-censorship person, but I just feel as though his position on free speech is not as absolute as Norman's, and I thought it would be interesting to get you two into a discussion. So let me just start off with a question for you, Bob. My understanding is that for you, the troubles that we're facing when it comes to the political discourse have to do with kind of tribalism that emerges, especially maybe online, but overall, and that what you would like to do is to create conditions where that tribalism is suppressed and also where cognitive empathy is sort of the leading principle in our political discourse. Do you see those aims as separate from the aim of creating conditions of absolute freedom around speech?
Let's see. Well, let me first say, yeah, the psychology of tribalism I consider a big problem. It's a misleading term in some ways, and it's an interesting term because actually it runs into trouble from some people who might be labeled woke. So it's kind of relevant to her question. I get flack for using it sometimes, but by that I just mean that human beings are designed, I think, you know, the brains are designed by natural selection to affiliate with groups, you know, disagree with other groups, and they have cognitive biases that abet that, and that leads to you know, needless tension and strife sometimes. I'm a big advocate of cognitive empathy, by which I mean not necessarily not emotional empathy, although that's fine too often, like, you know, feeling people's pain and so on, that has its place. But by cognitive empathy, I just mean understanding people's perspectives. Like I think, for example, I've spent a lot of time in my newsletter talking about how we should have done a better job of understanding Vladimir Putin's perspective for the last 25 years. Mm. Probably wouldn't be in a war if we'd done that. That's all true. I think you use the word suppressed or repressed. I'm never for the government suppressing speech. I guess I have tried to distinguish between that and the kind of you could call it the normative suppression of speech. You know, speech codes. Societies have always had speech codes. I think Norman in his most recent book spends some time talking about past speech codes, including those that prevailed in the Cold War. You know, they've always been with us. But I would say I have argued in the context of kind of social media, you know, when people complain about censorship on Twitter. You know, I again make this distinction between the government doing it and somebody else doing it. Now, Twitter raises kind of almost unique problems because it's kind of a de facto monopoly. And so you could argue that the norm, you know, that for there to be gatekeepers on Twitter is in some ways almost tantamount to the government doing it. And that's an interesting conversation to have. Let me say one more thing about my perspective before I get some feedback from you about what I've said, because I don't think I've been that clear in my position yet. I haven't done that much writing and thinking about free speech issues. The first time I wrote about it, I think, was in the New York Times in the context of the Danish cartoon controversy. And people may remember a Danish newspaper had kind of made a point of publishing a picture of Muhammad because they knew that would antagonize Muslims. And people were calling it censorship. If you criticize that newspaper, you were accused of favoring censorship, the suppression of free speech. And the piece I wrote was trying to emphasize that, no, there's a distinction between encouraging newspapers not to run certain kinds of things, which I would call the normative regulation of speech, and the government suppressing speech. And although I was critical of the newspaper, I wasn't arguing for the government to step in and shut down the newspaper or tell them what they could or couldn't publish. And I also made the argument that sometimes the normative regulation of speech is what creates a society where the government isn't tempted to come in and suppress speech. My main point is just that there have always been speech codes. Maybe there can be a successful society without speech codes, but we don't know because I'm not aware that there's ever been one. And personally, I can see a place for certain kinds of normative guidelines I would support in our society today. Although by and large, the ones that Norman complains about, I'd complain about too, I think, if that clarifies anything, which it probably doesn't.
Norman, what do you think about the distinction between censorship from the state and these normative codes that Robert's talking about, and what have you run up against around, you know, issues of free speech and institutional norms?
I think you have to make the term normative codes can be slightly deceptive because you have to discuss, I think, the content of these codes. You can make an argument, I have no problem with it, that there are certain principles of what you might call, I know it sounds kind of stuffy, restrictions on hurling epithets. I don't think a teacher should have the right to refer to a student as on the grounds of free speech. So I have no problem if one wants to restrict the use of denigrating epithets. However, if that's what's meant that by the expression, societies have always had normative codes, speech codes in that sense, sure and no problem. There is a slippery slope. If you call somebody a fascist pig or a Zionist pig, there is there a kind of gray area because fascist does have a content and Zionist does have a content. It's not a pure epithet or a capitalist pig. It's not a pure epithet, but I think any speech that has an ideational content, there's an idea there. There's an idea there. Maybe it's inchoate, but there's an idea there. It should not be restricted. And I see no grounds for restricting it. So basically, the only limit or restriction I would enter to the support for liberty of speech would be ideas or expressions which are devoid of ideational content. Now, even there, you have to be careful because does a person have to write, this was a Supreme Court case, does an individual have the right to walk into a courthouse wearing a shirt saying, fuck the draft? And our court actually decided, yes, that person has the right because the argument was speech is not just about ideas, but speech is also about giving vent to emotions. And there's probably an argument there. I'm talking more about what goes on, say, in a university. And in a university, I think you kind of make a, you sign a contract with the university that once you cross the threshold of the gates of a university, that you have to be willing to tolerate ideas. However offensive you might find them, you have an obligation to tolerate ideas. I don't believe, as I said, you have an obligation to tolerate speech which has no content and is just designed to be a conversation stopper. On the second question of government interference versus proprietary rights of an owner of some cyberspace, I consider that a separate issue. I recognize it raises thorny questions, but I think the more important question is, why would you want to censor any speech? What is the purpose? What is the objective? What is the goal? And is it justifiable? So I would prefer, rather than getting into this whole, it's basically a legal issue. You know, well, maybe no. At the end of the day, there are principles at stake, but it becomes it enters the terrain of proprietary rights, intellectual property law, and things like that. I find those very technical questions, and I prefer to leave those questions to lawyers and focus more on the question of exactly what does one want to achieve by limiting speech which has ideational content, and why would one want to argue that it's preferable to suppress, repress that kind of speech? I can't, having given a lot of reflection to it and having erred terribly at a certain point in my life, at this moment, and for the past, you could say, 30 years, I can no longer find any justification for limiting any kind of speech, except as John Stuart Mill says, unless you're certain that you possess some monopoly on truth. And insofar as you lack the certainty of that, I can't see any grounds for limiting the speech.
I want to ask you a question. You started out by saying that you are against government censorship, that's where you draw the line, mm-hmm. that you are okay with some sort of normative codes guiding people's private behavior or setting up, you know, codes within private institutions. Why are you against the government censoring things other than just because, you know, our Constitution protects us of that and you know, you might want to abide by the Constitution, but what is the principle there?
Well, the government, you know, has the guns. I mean, I just think it's particularly dangerous if they have the right to tell you what you can and can't say. I don't think anybody has the right to tell me what I can and can't say. You know, and back it up with force or any kind of real coercion, you know, aside from not inviting me to their parties and not letting me write for their magazines and arguably not letting me onto their social media platforms. Although, again, that becomes a thorny question once you've got a platform like Twitter, which basically has a monopoly on discourse among journalists, for example, at least so far as social media goes. You know, I'm by and large a free speech advocate. I for one thing want to be clear on our terms, and I would like to ask Norman what kinds of things he considers censorship. I pretty much confine that to the government. Well, let me give you an example. I mean, suppose you want to run an ideological magazine, or today we might say an ideological platform. And suppose it runs articles, it has a comment forum, so that people who read it can discuss things. But it is an ideological platform, like, you know, The Nation or National Review or whatever. And so you have clear ideological criteria. You know, you're there to advance a view. And if people submit an article advancing such and such, you say no. And maybe you're a little looser in the comments section, but still, you know, you have guidelines of some kind. I mean, I'm curious as to whether Norman would consider that censorship, just controlling speech on your own platform.
I wouldn't call it censorship, but I think certainly one can say that at certain moments, and maybe the predominant number of moments, there are elements of hypocrisy. So, for example, if you have a letters to the editor section of your newspaper and you claim that you entertain criticism of your coverage, your reportage, and you don't print certain letters, well, I would call that hypocrisy. If you claim that you have an op-ed page, which is supposed to represent dissenting points of view, and your range of dissenting points of view is very narrow and it excludes a large number of points of view, I would call that hypocrisy. But I would say it's correct to say that any group, any organization, and presumably any private party has the right to limit what it's going to publish. So that to me is not a problem. Where the problem obviously enters, and this is intrinsic to the whole question as a practical matter of freedom of speech, where the problem practically enters, as a practical matter enters, is when dissenters have no access to any mainstream venues, and they're basically locked out of the so-called marketplace of ideas. How you solve that question, I've thought about it for many decades because I'm always locked out. I'm not pitying myself. That comes with the turf of my beliefs. But how in an ideal society you would solve that question, I'm really unsure. Does a cigarette company have the right to post a huge billboard, say, in an inner city community, marketing an item which is going to cause real grief for people? And doesn't the other side, so to speak, which believes this item is very harmful, do they have a right to their own billboard paid by the government? Or do they have a right to half the billboard, which the company itself has to pay for? And I've thought about these questions. I don't really know how you handle them. I'll give you a practical example, and then you can, you're of course welcome to comment on it. There's this issue now being raised with Governor DeSantis censoring or attempting to censor, influence the African American studies curriculum for AP courses. And the argument is made, in my opinion, correctly, that a government official shouldn't be involved in making those sorts of decisions. The whole point historically of academic freedom, and I go through this quite closely in the book I just wrote, the whole point of academic freedom was to insulate academia from external influences, be it religion, which was their original influence that academia tried to insulate it from. Then there was big business at the turn of the 20th century. And then there was direct political interference during the McCarthy era. So the purpose of academic freedom was to insulate academic decisions from external influences. And the claim that was made, and it comes up in all academic freedom cases, and I go through at some length in the book one academic freedom case, which I found very interesting, the Bertrand Russell case, when he was denied the right to teach at City College because of his moral views. And Bertrand Russell, who understood the concept of academic freedom and had a mind capacious enough to defend it very intelligently, he said the first principle of academic freedom is only your peers should be making decisions on your academic competence, your academic qualifications. So on those grounds, I would say Governor DeSantis is out of bounds. Decisions about the content of an African-American studies curriculum should be made by those who have academic competence in this discipline. Where's the problem? Now, you may disagree with me, and of course, you're free to disagree with me because we believe in freedom of speech. Where the problem is, even if you leave it to experts in the discipline, leave it to experts in the discipline to make decisions. What should be the content of the curriculum? Who is competent to teach? I have to say, I'm now approaching 70 years of age, and my whole adult life, I was excluded by experts. I can't say it was some governor who intervened. In fact, Arnold Schwarzenegger, in one case I was involved in, he actually stood by me and said, by principles of academic freedom, University of California Press should have the right to publish a book by me, even as Professor Dershowitz thought that I should be denied the right to publish the book with University of California Press. But in general, experts, they also have their very can be limited framework. And they're imposing still, in my view, they're still imposing a certain element of censorship. That is to say, I thought I met the highest standards of scholarship. Raoul Hilberg, the leading founder of the field of Holocaust studies, agreed on that point. But still, I was locked out. Now, you may say to me, well, then what's your substitute? What would you replace it with? If you don't want experts rendering judgment on your academic competence, then what's your substitute? And here, I'm never afraid to say, I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question. But acknowledging it's a very tough question, still, I think, requires the other acknowledgement that legitimate bona fide scholars or legitimate bona fide dissenting opinions are going to be locked out,
So, Bob, I will just give you a chance to respond if you have a response. On the ready, I do have a question to maybe throw your way if you need a prompt.
The only thing I'd say is I agree that in principle, academic decisions about who teaches and what they can teach should be made by people expert in that field. As a practical matter, it's hard to insulate these decisions ultimately from other forces. I mean, in the case of DeSantis, I gather that's a state-run, state-financed college. Taxpayers pay for it. You don't have to really, think about it for very long to realize that you're just not going to wind up with some kind of pure, realm of pure, uninhibited speech. As a practical matter, even though that's actually the situation in which I think the courts would say the First Amendment most clearly applies is when as academic environments go, in other words, where it's a state university, and I'm God knows I'm not a legal scholar, but my understanding is that state universities, the people who run state universities have been taken as kind of tantamount to government for purposes of free speech issues, but it's going to be hard. There's the related question that academic fields change and the composition of them changes, and you can suddenly wind up where all of the almost all the recognized experts actually have a particular kind of bias in some, you know, from some kind of objective point of view. So there are all these practical problems. But look, I agree that in principle, you would want tenure decisions insulated from the pressure of donors and so on. And they certainly haven't been. And Norman knows that as well as anyone. So that's about all I have to say, I think, about that.
I would just want to, again, make a distinction between the practical consideration. And as you say, if it's a public university financed by taxpayer money, obviously there are going to be issues of how our tax money is being used, so to speak. But I think as a principled question, there should be no distinction whatsoever between a public and a private university. Either competent people are making these decisions or incompetent people are making these decisions. Remember, in the case of Bertrand Russell, it was City University of New York. And the lawsuit was exactly about, I'm a taxpayer, and to put it bluntly, they said, we don't want a pervert in our classrooms. And so even in the case of a public university, and even where the issue of taxpayer money arises, I still think the principle shouldn't change, that truth is not decided by acclamation, and it's not decided by voting. For all I know, you can be in a community where there's a large, for whatever reason, there's a large contingent of flat earthers. That doesn't mean that you're going to change the content of a science department to accommodate that public belief. And it has makes no difference whether it's a public institution or a private institution at the level of principle. At the level of principle, it shouldn't make a difference. Either we're teaching our students the highest quality scholarship and we're teaching them truth as we best understand it, or I think we're defeating the whole academic project.
You know, there's a question of what's pragmatic and practical as opposed to the principle, but even within the principle, there's some complications. On the one hand, you can't determine the truth just by asserting it or using power to maintain it. But on the other hand, in order to develop an idea, there are certain principles that you have to assume after establishing them in order to continue on. Like you have the germ theory of disease, and you don't question the germ theory of disease as you study germs and get a more complicated and thorough understanding of it. That doesn't mean that no one should be allowed to question the germ theory of disease, but rather just that as a not just as a practical matter, but as in terms of developing our understanding and of the truth, we have to hold on to certain ideas and stop questioning them. So Norman, how do you think that, I mean, I guess we've been talking about this in a way when we're talking about expert opinion, but how do we create conditions where we can develop our ideas and stop re-arguing, you know, the same problems over and over again, or stop hearing the same arguments? Should we allow flat earthers into the universities, despite the fact that there's no good evidence that the earth is flat?
The question of what you allow to be taught in university has two sides to it. On principle, anything and everything should be taught, which has, as I said, an ideational content. If there's an idea to contend with there, there should be room for it to be taught, or there should be room for it to at least be expressed in some context or another. But having said that, here I will allow for a practical principle. And the practical principle is called the economies of time. Namely, you only have so much time to teach, and certain areas are going to be excluded and other areas are going to be included. Certain areas of your discipline will be excluded, other areas potentially bearing on your discipline will be included. And because of economies of time, for example, you're teaching the Civil War, and certainly in the Civil War, you would want to have a discussion of whether the Civil War was about slavery or was it about competing economic systems in the North and the South of our Union. Those are completely reasonable areas of debate and discussion. But if somebody wants to come along and say, well, I have a theory that the Civil War was actually provoked by Martians, maybe there's some argument there, maybe there's some evidence, I've not seen it. But in terms of economies of time, well, we're teaching a course in American history, Civil War is one unit, and we just don't have the time to discuss the Martian-instigated Civil War. So there's always the issue of economies of time. And on those grounds, I would say, for example, which I discuss at great length in the book, a Holocaust denier should not have a platform in the university department. If you want to invite a Holocaust denier speaker, of course, you should have that right. And if you want to distribute his or her latest publications, of course, you should have that right. But because of economies of time, I would say the Holocaust deniers don't raise significant, at least at this point in time, significant theoretical or practical questions that warrant giving over a class to it. But there's one caveat. Let us say, as many Holocaust mongers will tell you, the Holocaust denial is pervasive in our society. That everywhere you look, people are denying the Holocaust. Well, I happen to think that's nonsense, but let's say that were true. Were it true, then I would say emphatically it should be taught so as to expose the fallacy of that belief. Otherwise, people will begin to wonder, well, why aren't they talking about that? Why are they so afraid to talk to listen to what the Holocaust deniers say? So I could see were it true, which I think is not, has no basis in reality, had a particular phenomenon. Let's say you take the case that COVID was a government conspiracy. Okay, somebody said that it was manufactured by the government for X, Y, or Z reasons. If that became a pervasive belief, if it spread like wildfire, went viral on the web, then I think it's completely crazy, not to mention counterproductive, to suppress it. Because all you're then doing is giving rise to questions about why is it being suppressed if it's so ridiculous? Why not just answer it? So once a phenomenon becomes pervasive, the idea of using social media space to repress it, I think A, is completely counterproductive, and B, I think reservations, doubts by large numbers of people, they ought to be answered. Maybe there is an interesting question being raised there. I don't know, but I would be curious to hear the answer. I had friends, one of my roommates in college, I recently contacted him. We periodically are in touch. And he started with all of this. Well, we all know that the virus was started in the Wuhan laboratory.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's a major theory. No, right. It's like it's one of the two.
And by the way, he does cancer research at Cleveland Clinic. Mm-hmm. He does cancer research at Cleveland Clinic. And I said, Charlie, that might be true, but I can say we all know. I mean, I've read articles in Nature magazine.
Yeah.
It's not fact. And in instances like that, to try to suppress doubts about the origins of COVID or the utility of a vaccine, I think are counterproductive. And I also think they're wrong. I have to say,
Norman, I want to give Bob a chance.
Quickly, and I'll hear you out, I promise you.
Yeah.
You know, one of my dear friends is over decades is Professor Chomsky. Mm-hmm. And Professor Chomsky, who's a man of science, that's closest to his heart. It's not politics, it's science. He had very harsh remarks about those who didn't want to take the vaccine. And at some point, he seemed to imply they should all be put in effectively concentration camps to insulate the rest of the public from the dangers they posed. Mm-hmm. Now, he's the man of science. I'm not a man of science by a wide margin. I'm not. However, I did find the disdain he expressed, I found it a bit off the mark for the following reason. Number one, Bernie Sanders went on national television during his whole presidential campaign talking about how crooked Big Pharma was. Don't trust Big Pharma. Big Pharma are crooks. Don't trust Big Pharma. Big Pharma are crooks. Mm. I happen to think Big Pharma are crooks also. That's my point of view, okay? Mm-hmm. So if that's what you believe, and that's what large numbers of Bernie's supporters, myself included, believe, there was prima facie, there was grounds to be skeptical about the vaccine. Now, I'm not saying the skepticism was correct, but there was grounds for skepticism. Mm-hmm. Because our medical system is very crooked, and all sorts of products are being marketed just for profits and not right. for mental health or physical health. So in those instances, why would you want to suppress any discussion of the value or the merit of the vaccine? I don't get right. it at all.
Yeah. I was going to segue into this question about the way in which free speech is taken up in our politics today, and you've kind of given me a great way to do that. It's to me surprising that Noam Chomsky, who is, I think, one of the most preeminent free speech absolutists on the scene, would have that attitude about the vaccines, because I would imagine it would come along with, maybe not stated, that, you know, he would want to suppress those who would question the use of the vaccine. I'm not sure if that's the case or not. But, Bob...
You know, Doug, can I just say he may not be. I mean, there's a whole separate argument he could make that, you know, contagious disease has, it creates particular... choosing not to get vaccinated when there's a contagious disease, assuming that the vaccine works and so on, and of course, speech about that should be uninhibited. But there is an argument that because not getting vaccinated puts others at risk, there is a role for the government. And you can always come up with a thought experiment that would get a lot of people to agree, right? Like, okay, let's say it's a fatal disease. It kills everyone. And the transmissibility is like X. And then everybody goes, well, yeah, I guess if somebody's refusal to get vaccinated is going to kill everybody in the country, the government has to step in. That's probably the kind of argument Chomsky was making, and probably he would say is unrelated to free speech.
Right, that's true. But you can see that if you think that questioning the efficacy of the vaccine could lead to people not taking the vaccine, therefore, you know, you would want to suppress right. the speech. But what I want to ask you, Bob, is every week you talk to Mickey Kouse, who is a very strange character. He started out as a Marxist and is now.
Was Mickey ever a Marxist?
I interviewed him about it.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, he was a Marxist. He was part of a member of SDS anyway. Back in the day.
I wish he had frozen himself in time then, but
yeah. Well, he says he's still abides by those principles today, or would like to, except he doesn't believe in the working class anymore. Which I think means he's not a Marxist. He's a free speech absolutist on your show. He's very concerned about free speech, that and the child tax credit and immigration. Why do you think it is that the right has become at least perceived to be more of a champion of free speech today? Although you know, in Florida, this suppression of critical race theory puts that to rest, I guess. But why do you think it is that the right is more concerned about free speech than the left?
If I could pause for a promotional, you mentioned Mickey, and earlier you said the podcast didn't have any clear name. The place to find it is, I have a podcast called the Non-Zero Podcast. I do 2 a week. One is with Mickey, and then that's public, and then there's also after-hours paywall discussion called the Parrot Room, but Non-Zero is the place to start. Let me first say something I've said to Mickey and is relevant to what Norman was saying, I think, which is that, you know, the for all the complaining about, you know, censorship on Twitter and so on, and for all the complaints emanating from the so-called intellectual dark web about the suppression of speech and so on, I think, especially if you leave academia aside, although I'm not sure this doesn't apply there too, but if you just talk about kind of the public square, media, so on, I think it's much easier now to get traction for a heterodox idea than it was when I was young. You know, when Norman and I were kids, there were three TV networks, absolute gatekeeping there. There were two news magazines, or maybe you could say three, that had tremendous influence. There were a fair number of municipal newspapers. On the other hand, they all depended on advertising and so on, and that posed limits. So if you had an idea like the vaccine is actually a government, I think it was, it's actually a government plot. I think it was harder to get a big following for it than it is in today's ecosystem. Now, as for the question, and that's just, I'm not saying that's good or bad, again, there have always been gatekeepers. There still are gatekeepers. It's changed a lot, though. And I will say, in some realms, to my mind, they exert an incredible amount of power given the what would seem to be a very open, you know, technologically open ecosystem of opinion. The dominant ideas in American foreign policy are the dominant ideas, you know, they remain, and they're kind of, I mean, is, you know, what Chomsky said about manufactured consent, that's an interesting idea to revisit in the modern technological environment. Maybe things have gotten a little better, but by and large, I think his argument still applies. So on the one hand, I do think there's kind of more heterodoxy getting more traction out there. On the other hand, there are kinds of gatekeepers that are pretty strong. As for why this is coming from the right, well, first of all, there's this interesting phenomenon where people on the fairly far left, like Glenn Greenwald, are agreeing with the people on the right on a certain amount of this stuff, about the suppression of ideas on Twitter. You know, Matt Taibbi, traditionally on the left, is one of the guys Elon Musk anointed to talk about how repressive the old Twitter regime had been. So there is this interesting kind of convergence of left and right. I mean, I guess I mentioned the intellectual dark web, and I think that's an interesting point in the history of all this, because that was the point when, well, even there, like, I think of that as the right for my own reasons. I think of that as largely a right-wing thing. Now, maybe that's because I pay so much attention to foreign policy. I don't know. But Brett Weinstein will tell you he voted for Bernie Sanders, right? He's one of the guys. He, by his account, which I think is probably more or less accurate, he was kind of chased out of this small state-run but very Evergreen. Progressive liberal arts, Evergreen College. Mm. He would say he's on the left, and he's complaining about this stuff. But I think part of the answer to your question is, there has emerged with the generation now in college and the generation, you know, for over the last 15 or 20 years, what you could call, I mean, it's at a lot of liberal arts colleges, at least, a lot of campuses, not all, you know, a kind of a woke orthodoxy that and the backlash to the right is a backlash against that. In other words, it's because some ideas associated with the left started gaining dominance within academia, or at least that was the perception, that the backlash came from the right. You know, it could have worked the other way. The pendulum swings back and forth, but I think that's just where we are in time. And I'm some of those ideas associated with the woke left, I'm not a fan of. I do think that sometimes I wonder whether the magnitude of the problem isn't overstated. I mean, for example, I gave a talk at a college called Marist College in New York, and I talked to the president. I said, you know, I don't see any of this woke stuff here. And he said, no, there's really not much. And this was about 5 or 6 years, but there are colleges like this, that you know, there is. And I will say I'm not a credentialed academic, but I taught a couple of seminars at Princeton about 7 or 8 years ago when the backlash against this was just starting to surface. And I assigned a book of mine, The Moral Animal, about evolutionary psychology that by all accounts should have gotten me canceled, you know. Mm-hmm. And now it's true, I didn't assign the chapters that were called things like male and female, men and women. There are chapters called that. But you would expect that I would have, even that students would have, you know, tracked down. To judge by what you're hearing about colleges, you would have expected some of the students to like go find the passages that they could crucify me with. There wasn't any of that. It was all fine. And so I'm not sure. And I taught at Union Theological Seminary, which is like woke central. I taught a seminar. And, you know, there was a student at the beginning who said, you know, the course was called something like Science and Spirituality. On the first day, started talking about, you know, the way science has been controlled by the male patriarchy. And I said, you know, science, like everything else, runs through the biases of human beings, and it's an imperfect instrument. But this is not going to be a course that is a postmodern critique of science. We're going to start with what the scientific consensus is in certain fields or something like it and talk about the implications for spirituality. She dropped out of the class. It was okay. So I tend to think in general one phenomenon now is that you know, it is a very tribal, polarized environment. And I think the magnitude of problems in each tribe tends to be exaggerated by the other tribe. And I think social media, it's like one Trump supporter in some supermarket will start freaking out about a mask mandate and they'll video it. And then somebody will post it on Twitter and say, oh, these Trump supporters, they're always freaking out in supermarkets about mask mandates. Actually, they almost never freak out in supermarkets. But this is just one person, and we're turning it into, you know, I mean, there is division of opinion on the mask thing. It's intense. It's just that the people we're seeing who are being depicted as representative of the other group are often not entirely representative. I suspect some of that goes on in on college. Now, that said, there are these stories that I think are real. I think Brett Weinstein's is probably basically real. Again, Norman has his own history that he's sufficiently conversant in for me not to need to repeat it. These things happen. But I do wonder, well, A, whether the problem has been to some extent exaggerated, the problem of, you know, woke mobs on campus. I also wonder whether the pendulum isn't starting to swing a little. I noticed that Princeton now put on its application an essay question about, you know, basically saying, convince us you're committed to free speech. It was like, tell us about a time when you've heard another, you know, an opinion you disagreed with. It was something like that. The point is, it was a very, I think they're starting to screen, you know, for trying to screen out some of the more the vehement opponents of free speech.
You know, we agreed at the outset that we talked for about 45 minutes. We're at 50. I'm not going to do 2.5 hours, Bob, and make people sit through that.
I've been known to do, I know.
Yeah, no. But I want to ask you both like one last question, and then we'll break. And I think that the idea is you're going to send Norman a link to Zoom. so you can record for your channel.
That's right.
And would you be able to make that available to me so that I can give that to the on my patrons in advance of it coming out on your channel? Would that be all right with you, or at the same time?
Well, not in advance, but we'll have to work it out. I think there's also technically a YouTube issue about posting the exact same video two different places. But I think the fact that we put our own little beginning on it will exempt us from that problem. I'm not sure, but
okay. Well, we'll talk about it, because I would like to be able to, because I have a Parrot Room. I actually call it the Parrot Room. I do.
We're and flattered. Because
you said that you wanted every podcaster to just call their patron content the Parrot Room once.
Yeah.
Like and make it like a Xerox. So I did that, and no one else has picked it up, but I'm trying to get the trend. So
God bless you. We'll give you a plug.
Yeah. But anyway, I'd like to put that on. Here's the final question.
Before you ask the final question, may I just briefly comment on what I thought was a fair point by Robin? Mm-hmm. I wanted to second it and admit to there being a nebulous area. And that's the question, which is a legitimate one. How pervasive is this phenomenon called cancel culture? How pervasive is woke culture? How pervasive is identity politics? And is there a kind of distortion occurring of the kind that I think you excellently described? The one person in the supermarket who doesn't wear the mask, and then somebody draws the inference, we have a problem now, nobody wants to wear the mask. No, it was one person who didn't want to wear the mask. And here I would say that one has to be discriminating. One can't just indulge in broad generalizations. So I've been teaching at City University now, not adjunct teaching, a course there. I've had probably around 250 students so far. There's only one student who's made an issue of his pronouns, sends me emails every few weeks. Please remember my pronouns are this, that, and the other. And if you don't recall my pronouns correctly, please make a point of correcting yourself in class, and so on and so forth. But truth be told, like you say, one student out of 250, it's never become a source of significant contention. Though, as you know, one student could cause a real problem for you. One complaint, once it hits the human resources, it's a problem, and we shouldn't deny it. The second thing I would say is, yes, it's limited to a certain number of fields, the problem. Obviously, it's barely affected the natural sciences. And I have friends in the natural sciences who were genuinely surprised when I showed them, look, Nature magazine is now saying pregnant people, or things like that, people who menstruate. I said, you see it now in these very reputable, the most reputable scientific magazines. He was genuinely surprised. And he was a biomathematician at NYU, so he was deeply steeped in his area, apparently so deeply steeped he didn't even know what was going on around him. And I said, no, this is a real problem. So in general, it's not been a problem in the natural sciences, and even in fields like economics, which is entirely mathematical now, it's had very little impact. There are a broad number of humanities fields where I think it has had a significant impact. And I have to say, a very depressing one. I'm not a conservative, as you know, but I do believe in the great books and things like that. They are great. And they may change sometimes over time, but there's a core that's pretty damn good. You go look in English departments. Look at the course offerings. I mean, you really have to search very hard. I'm serious now. You have to search very hard to find a course on Shakespeare. You have to search very hard to find a course on Dickens. You have to search very hard to find a 19th century novel, unless they're women. That's a fact. Because I've sat down with students, and I want them to take the best English and philosophy courses, because they want to be lawyers. So I said, if you want to be a lawyer, lawyering is about reasoning and it's about composition, major in philosophy, major in English. I sit down with them on the web, go through the course offerings. There's nothing there. It's Haitian American female writers, Dominican American female writers, Mexican American. I'm serious. I mean, I wish I could be making it up. And I'm thinking to myself, how can you have an entire course on Filipino American female writers? How could that be? And there, I think the effect has been very, it's real. And it's been, I can't say a mixed blessing. I think it's been a catastrophe, frankly.
Is the philosophy department better than the literature department?
I think this is a very depressing thing to have to say. And I'm not going to name the school because I love the school. It's been my favorite place to teach in my entire adult life. I took him to the philosophy department. Now, this is it's a branch of City University of New York, very large student population. I think you'll be shocked. When we went to the philosophy department, there were four, you hear me? 1, 2, 3, 4 course offerings. In other disciplines, you'd have 30. Let's say mine, political science, you'll have like 30. Four. That's a problem, a different nature problem. It's the job market. Nobody's going to major in a field which has no connection whatever to a job. So students don't want to take, you know, students are very pragmatic now about what courses they're going to take. It has to have some connection with a job, first of all, because they're paying, you know, so that's.
How's a philosophy major and as an undergraduate? Look at me now. Last question for both of you, which is kind of following up on what we were just talking about. Do you think that we may be entering into a moment where the question of woke censorship is diminishing in significance? Rather than worrying about being censored for misgendering someone, we might want to worry about more substantial questions around censorship, especially given how during the COVID pandemic, the vaccine, you know, being skeptical about the vaccine was censored. Now it seems that if you have the wrong opinion on the war in Ukraine, you can be shut down. Are we no longer really facing the woke mob and just facing straight ahead state censorship? Bob, you can start. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, on the war in Ukraine, I've been bothered by, this isn't full on McCarthyism. If you say, as I've said, I think NATO expansion was a mistake. We made a lot of other mistakes and we needlessly increased the probability that something like this war would happen. You get accused of reciting, quote, Putin talking points or being a Putin apologist, which is just silly because, first of all, it's possible that Vladimir Putin has said something true at some point in his life. So the fact that you're saying what he's saying is not necessarily a scathing indictment of your cognitive abilities or your patriotism. People... very prominent people in journalism do this kind of thing. And, you know, Ivo Dalder, prominent figure in foreign policy who runs the Chicago Council on the equivalent of the regular Council on Foreign Relations, who was former ambassador to NATO, I think, whom I respect by and large. But I saw him doing a little of this kind of Putin talking point thing. And it bothers me. On the other hand, I'd say that those of us who are resisting that and trying to persist in what we consider to be a worthwhile analysis of how we got into this mess, we're not dead. We're not silenced. We're in touch. There's kind of a network. There is now actually for the first time in my memory, an actual foreign policy think tank of some substance in Washington, the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, that that is, you know, heterodox on foreign policy. I mean, they use the term, I guess, restrainers. It's kind of a left-right coalition of people who are very skeptical about the use of American military force. At the same time, I just I am dismayed at just how readily, you know, we've sunk into the kind of standard mindset of war. It's as if we were personally involved in the war. And of course, we are more and more deeply involved in it. But, you know, it's like, you know, I went through the Iraq thing and I was against the Iraq war before the war happened. And it was a similar kind of like, am I crazy thing? It's like, I don't, it seems like I'm making some reasonable points here. And it's just like you get shouted down. So that's all disconcerting. It's I don't think it's worse than it was during the Cold War, but it's disconcerting that it's as hard as it is to just have a serious conversation. The last thing I'd like to say on kind of a different point is just that this whole business of how the colleges are, you know, you can call it identity politics, how they are Norman was saying he thinks they're catering a bit too much to the special concerns that arise in a kind of an ethnically diverse country. It's like there's only so much time you should spend on female Filipino writers or whatever. I'm sure I would have no trouble finding examples where I agree that, things have gone too far. I would also say that having a coherent multi-ethnic society, historically speaking, seems to be a challenge, right? A lot of countries have failed spectacularly. There have been civil wars and things. Not all that many countries have succeeded. And I guess I would just say this is an area where, to get back to what I said at the beginning about the normative regulation of speech, where like, for example, just racial slurs, although they shouldn't be illegal, the government shouldn't suppress them. I would say, a good thing that if you use one, you don't get invited to certain parties, and maybe that you don't are not admitted to certain social media platforms, even though, as I said, distinctive problems arise when a dominant social media platform is owned by one person. But I guess what I'm just saying is I don't think we should underestimate the challenge of maintaining a coherent multi-ethnic society. And I suspect that if there's going to be a successful, coherent multi-ethnic society, there will be speech codes that are fairly effectively enforced in a sheerly normative way. Is that
Norman?
Makes sense?
Where are we moving? First of all, I would say, based on my experience, most, if I can use the expression, unpopular, but I'll use it anyway, working class kids never gave a hoot about the identity politics, the woke politics. They have bigger concerns in life, like paying the rent, literally, this is not hyperbole, literally paying the rent, paying their bills, having a roof over their head, and managing to hold down two or three jobs and go to school at night without falling to sleep. So whether you call me he, him, she, her, or they, them, that's a big concern for Judith Butler, but not a high priority among most of the kids I've seen going in and out of my classroom. The woke culture has a kind of cultural salience. You might call it the Martha's Vineyard culture. And it has spawned all of these jobs, I suppose, you know, the Robin DiAngelo type jobs, the diversity coaches, human resources, and it's played a particularly pernicious role in Democratic Party politics. In my opinion, and I'm not at all prone to conspiracy theories, very far from it. In the Democratic Party, the basic purpose of identity politics was to find a new base once they rolled off the white working class. and it became identity politics, which became its new base. It's very obvious to see if your memory is long enough. I don't know how old Robin Wright is, but if you go back to 1984 and you listen to the keynote address by Mario Cuomo, it was this great paean to the working class, the Democratic Party being the class of the working class, and it was casting all sorts of aspersions on the ruling class, the economic elites. That's what the Democratic Party was in 1984. Now, fast forward, if you look at the Democratic Party conventions, 2016, 2020, you have barely a mention of the working class. What you have is all of this cultural diversity. Its main purpose was to create a new base for the Democratic Party. And once the Bernie Sanders phenomenon came along, the main purpose or the main objective of identity politics was to derail, and here it sounds conspiratorial, and I acknowledge that, was to derail a class-based politics. So what you had in 2016, 2020, Ta-Nehisi Coates criticizing Bernie for being weak on Black reparations, Angela Davis, Kimberly Crenshaw criticizing Bernie for being weak on the Black issue, Gloria Steinem saying Bernie Sanders is weak on the female issue. It's all the Bernie bros. The whole identity politics, it kind of converged. There was this confluence, and its main purpose was to serve as a juggernaut to stop the Bernie insurgency. Where things are heading, I happen to think if we survive, and that's a genuine issue. I think, you know, one doesn't want to sound like Cassandra, but we're facing, if I can use the expression, which is way overused, we're facing real existential threats right now, not just the threat of climate change, which is real. There is a genuine threat now, and I don't think it's been fully absorbed by the mainstream society. There is a genuine threat now of a nuclear conflagration. And not the kind that people normally think, that there's going to be an escalation of both sides, as John Mearsheimer puts it, between the U.S., NATO, and Russia, gradual escalation until Putin feels up against the wall and he's going to use nuclear weapons. I don't think that's the main danger. To my thinking, and we can obviously disagree on this, the main danger is the United States so indiscriminately and so capriciously supplied state-of-the-art precision technology to Ukrainian army, which you're not allowed to say, it's a Putin talking point. There are an awful lot of Nazi crazies in that army. I'm not saying it's a majority, but it's a significant number, call it 5%, call it 10%, who, if it looks as if they're losing the war, what they're going to do with those precision state-of-the-art military technology, I frankly am terrified of. Are they going to tear? Let's say they lose the battle right now in Bakhmut. Are they going to target a Russian nuclear reactor? I don't think that's out of bounds. These are crazy people. And they are right-wing crazies. They may decide it's time for the Samson option. Let's take down the temple with us. And we saw a sample of that when the nuclear reactor under Russian control, they were firing, I don't believe it was Russia, I think the whole idea is crazy, they were firing rockets in the vicinity of the reactor. Why, in my opinion? They were sending a message. The message was, if we go, we're taking you with us. So we have a real problem there. Let's hope by some miracle, we pass this Ukraine problem. Well, before we can catch our breath, right now, as we speak, we're facing the China problem. Mm-hmm. We're facing a war with China. Will we as a humanity survive a war with China? I'm very doubtful. So I hope that people will gain some clarity that we're facing real problems here, and those problems are not your pronouns. The problem is the survival of humanity, which is, I think, and I don't claim to be a great mind, but I do follow politics. I think it's becoming a very significant problem that we just may not make it. How can you, in the middle of a war in Ukraine, send over Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan to stir up trouble with China?
Mm-hmm. So, well, on that lovely and altered true note, let's end the conversation on that note. If you enjoyed this conversation, please do consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons help to make sure that Sublation Media can continue to provide interviews, videos, books, and articles that are critical of the left from the left. If you are tired of remaining stuck within bourgeois ideologies and politics, help us sublate them both.